Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by San Francisco State University's graduate business programs offering 5 accredited advanced degrees, the SF State MBA, rigorous, real-world, respected, open house schedule, and more information at mba.sfsu.edu.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information available at chevron.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. This week's home foreclosure deal could send billions to California, but will it really make a difference? And a huge expansion of a national park where land once eyed by developers for pricey homes will now be preserved as open space.
It is teeming with wildlife. Mountain lions are abundant. Deer and every critter you can think of that's native to this area.
Also, a new exhibit in Riverside uses sound and music to bring a Native American ghost story to life. And from the battlefields to the kitchen, former Marine uses wartime survival skills to cook up organic foods.
The hot sauce is it has 3 superfoods in there. It has maca, spirulina, and mesquite.
It's the California Report. And we begin today with a deeper dive into the national mortgage settlement announced this week. California Attorney General Kamala Harris joined the deal at the last minute after her negotiating team ironed out a side deal with 5 of the nation's biggest banks. She unveiled the details Thursday at a press conference in Los Angeles.
The deal ain't done just based on a promise. It's based on a promise and acceptance and then performance.
And of course, it'll take time to measure that performance. But many Californians are already dubious of the deal, as the California Report's Rachel Miro tells us.
Tom Goida is a spokesman for Wells Fargo, the only one of the 5 banks headquartered in California.
You know, we believe the agreement represents a very important step toward restoring confidence in mortgage servicing and the stability of the housing market.
That's even though Goida says the San Francisco banking giant has already reformed its loan servicing following previous deals and enforcement actions. He says Wells Fargo doesn't know yet how many of its customers might be affected by the mortgage settlement, but the company does know how much it's agreed to spend.
$5.3 billion. Approximately $900 million of that is for the refinance program, $3.4 billion for the consumer relief programs, including the expanded first and second mortgage modification efforts, and then $1 billion of it is a one-time foreclosure assistance payment that is being made directly to the states and participating federal agencies that they will then put to use as they see fit.
It's not going to help a large number of people. It's not going to solve the foreclosure crisis by any means, and it's not an amount of relief that's commensurate with the harm caused.
Kevin Stein is with the California Reinvestment Coalition, which represents 300 nonprofits, including housing counselors across the state. Stein says for all the talk of reform, many counselors report banks are still engaging in what's called dual tracking. That is, the bank is simultaneously working to modify a mortgage with the homeowner while proceeding with foreclosure on that same home.
We're not arguing everyone's home should be saved. We're saying give people fair consideration. What we think we're talking about are reasonable protections, and hopefully the Attorney General will be leading the charge.
He wants to see new state legislation to protect consumers. In the meantime, Stein calls the mortgage deal a good first step. So does Peggy Mears. She's a community organizer with the LA Office of the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment. Mears says, if nothing else, the attorneys general got big banks to talk seriously about principal reduction, refinancing mortgages to reflect the drop in property values that's happened in the last few years.
They were able to get the banks to do something that the banks would never consider doing for your average citizen if they tried to get them to do it.
If banks insist on loans locked in at the height of the last housing boom, Mears says, they guarantee future waves of foreclosures throughout California.
When you have a foreclosed home, it brings down the value of the homes around it. It takes money from the taxes, which affects school, which affects public safety. So it's a trickle-down effect. It's not just the homeowner that's suffering. It's everyone around them.
This week's deal focuses on people who haven't foreclosed yet, not so much the people who've already lost their homes. Some of them may be eligible for restitution of up to $2,000. That feels like a kick in the stomach to Monica Kenny of San Francisco.
I emptied my retirement account.
Kenny expects to be evicted from her home next week. She bought a tiny house in a working-class neighborhood, but found the payments too steep to sustain, especially after she lost a job as a maintenance mechanic at a water treatment plant. Kenny says Wells Fargo auctioned off her house one day after the bank granted her a forbearance. $2,000, she says, is less than one of her old monthly mortgage payments.
This restitution, quote-unquote, does not even remotely equal the amount of footwork, of legwork, of phone calls, of you know, sleepless nights, of fear, of all of these horrible emotions that not only I have gone through, but millions of people have suffered.
Fannie Mae now owns her home. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are not part of the mortgage deal just announced. Attorney General Harris has vowed to focus on them next, while appointing a monitor to oversee enforcement of the settlement. For the California Report, I'm Rachel Miro.
Before the housing market collapsed, upscale homes were planned for a scenic swath of the coast just south of San Francisco. But now, after 10 years of negotiating, Rancho Corral de Tierra is part of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, a jewel of acreage that includes Alcatraz Island, Muir Woods, and many other Bay Area landmarks. Amy Standen paid a visit to the new park and found that not all the tensions with local residents have been resolved.
On the day I visited Rancho Corral de Tierra, a thick fog hung under the peak of Montera Mountain, blocking what might otherwise have been views straight out to the Farallon Islands and Mount Tamalpais to the north. But with 3,800 acres of cypress trees and rolling hills, you could almost imagine what the California coast might have looked like when Spanish explorers wandered by just north of here in 1769. Things here could have been very different.
This was going to be housing and a golf course.
Audrey Rust is former president of the Peninsula Open Space Trust, known as POST. She says she'd been eyeing this piece of land since she started at the trust 25 years ago.
First of all, it is only 7 miles south from the border of San Francisco, and it is teeming with wildlife. Mountain lions are abundant. Deer and every critter you can think of that's native to this area.
But acquiring the ranch was a huge project, one that required fundraising on a scale closer to what you might expect from a major hospital or a university.
The goal of which was to raise $200 million and to save 20,000 acres of land.
Silicon Valley came to the rescue. Rust raised $50 million each from the Packard and Moore Foundations. That let Post buy the ranch for $29 million and then hold on to it for 9 years until the state government and Congress agreed to buy it from Post. After much political wrangling, Congress finally added the ranch to the National Park System last summer. Rust was ecstatic.
You're jumping around and sometimes crying. But, now it just feels right.
From the park's perspective, the addition of the ranch is historic, says Alex Picavet with the GGNRA.
So this is the largest land acquisition for Golden Gate National Recreation Area, pretty much since it began.
As national parks go, Golden Gate is a little unusual. It's 82,000 acres of parkland are scattered around the Bay Area, from Muir Woods to Alcatraz and Ocean Beach in San Francisco. But the new land on the peninsula means that about half of the park is now in San Mateo County, with this new chunk forming the southernmost border.
We were calling this the southern entryway to Golden Gate National Recreation Area.
Now that Rust and others have taken the long view, people like Susie Bennett can focus on the small things.
And here's our plant.
Bennett is a naturalist for the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. She's pointing with great pride to a little yellow flower with heart-shaped petals.
This is a very, very special plant. It's only found in two places in the whole world.
It's called Hickman's Potentilla.
It's in the rose family. And since you can't see it, I'll describe it. It has nice, shiny leaves. kind of like a fern.
It's also a federally endangered species, the only one in this new part of the park.
And so it's a real plant that we'd like to focus the management on.
The point here is that in taking over this land, the National Park Service is doing a lot more than just putting up new signs. There will be scientists studying the land and workers clearing out invasive species. The system of informal trails that locals have used for years will get an overhaul. And like any new neighbor, the park is going to have to win over local residents.
We've had nothing but a great community here for 32 years. And the minute they come, they ruin it.
Peggy and Bill Bechtel and their dog Kaylee live across the street from the park.
Everybody's upset. Everybody's furious and frightened.
Bechtel is referring to an incident late last month that made national headlines.
Dog walkers in the normally peaceful Rancho Corral de Tierra open space near Montera are on edge.
This is NBC Bay Area.
A national park ranger used her stun gun on a dog walker.
According to the GGNRA, Gary Hesterberg of Montera was walking his two dogs off leash in violation of park rules. A ranger tried to give him a ticket, but he gave her a false name and refused to stop. Critics called it excessive force, and a local congresswoman wants an independent investigation. But the bigger issue here isn't going away. National parks, as a rule, don't allow off-leash dogs, and this has been a sticking point for some in the Bay Area for more than a decade. As a result, the park has made exceptions in places like Fort Funston, south of San Francisco's Ocean Beach, and in the Marin Headlands. Officials had hoped that the new park would follow those national standards with limited leash-only dog areas. Bill Bechtel, who has been taking his dogs here since the 1980s, says if that's the case, he and others will fight it.
There's plenty of room for open space, animals, wildlife, everything, and recreation.
Last week, park officials announced that they're considering including some off-leash areas in Rancho Corral. Again, the park's Alex Picavet.
But we are looking forward to building that relationship with the community over the next many years. We're here for the long haul.
Over the next year, GGNRA will be working out parking, signage, and other issues, including dog policy. But the property is currently open to visitors. For the California Report, I'm Amy Standen.
Many veterans returning home to California after deployment to Iraq or Afghanistan have a tough time adjusting to civilian life, and their unemployment rate is higher than the state average. But with the right help, some are discovering that the skills they learn to survive in battle can help make a successful transition. Allison St. John of KPBS in San Diego reports.
Mike Haynes has come a long way since he returned from Iraq in 2004. When he got back from his second deployment with a Marine reconnaissance unit, he did not have an easy time.
You just don't come back and it's all gone. Because turning that, the on switch that's been triggered when you're in combat is, it's turned on, but turning it off is a very difficult process at times. I just had some tremendous trust issues and some very serious anger issues as well.
Haynes tried to hold down a job, but it didn't last long. At the age of 29, he went back to college, and for 2 years he was homeless, living in canyons like this one in North County. He points out the kind of deep undergrowth where he could sleep undisturbed.
So I'll go to school, do my homework at the computer room. When they close, that's when I would go out and find a place. So I'd crash out there at night. Some of my books in my bag,
This is where his Marine reconnaissance training came in handy. Haynes remembers how his unit would patrol during the night and then during the day hide from the enemy under thick brush. Along with his skills at surviving outdoors, Haynes says he developed a passion for raw edible plants while he was training at the Marine SEER School.
SEER School is a school that all recon Marines have to go through because it's a prisoner of war training school. SEER is S-E-R-E. It stands for Survive, Evade, Resist, Escape. So they teach you a little bit about survival, how to survive if you're captured. So I started learning about wild edible plants during that time.
That knowledge helped Haynes turn his life around when he got the chance to attend a 6-week course last year. It's called the Veteran Sustainable Agriculture Training Course. It's held at a farm in San Diego's backcountry. There he found kindred spirits who taught him how to use his love of natural foods to make a business plan. Thanks to that business plan, today Haynes is producing his own brand of hot sauce. He calls it Forager Mike's Dang Hot Sauce. It's made at a small organic food production company, where his recipe, with all raw organic ingredients, is mixed up in big blenders and bottled.
The hot sauce is it has three superfoods in there. It has maca, spirulina, and mesquite.
Haynes checks out the labels and the boxes of bottles ready to be distributed. A few months ago, Dang hot sauce hit the shelves here at Whole Foods. It was through the veterans training course that Haynes met Dwight Detter, a buyer at Whole Foods, who helped him with his labeling and his packaging. Detter is a veteran himself.
There was a different connection with Mike, and I think it was being back from the war and remembering how difficult that transition period was.
Detter immediately saw the potential of Dang hot sauce with its all raw organic ingredients as a hot seller.
So you have a unique flavor, you have some unique ingredients in it, and along with Mike's story, makes for a triply fun hot sauce to put on the shelves.
Haynes is no longer living in canyons, though he still spends a lot of time in nature.
Now, I'm always trying to learn more and more about wild edible and medicinal plants and how to use them, because I see it as so extremely empowering to be able to go out in the woods and know that, hey, I can survive. So yes, I'm building more and more on that, and I kind of incorporate that to my business to establish the high integrity foods.
Haynes has a 9-year-old daughter, and he's looking forward to be able to support her. And he has big plans for the future. He hopes if the hot sauce catches on, his brand, Forager Mike, will start producing a line of other raw organic foods. For the California Report, I'm Allison St. John in San Diego.
Tell us what you think about stories you hear or want to hear on the California Report. Send your email to calreport@kqed.org. You can also comment on specific stories online. Just go to californiareport.org. While you're there, you'll see everything we archive. And if you feel like listening on your own time, check out our podcast. You can sign up for it at californiareport.org or look for us at iTunes. As the home of mandolin master David Grisman and the Turtle Island Quartet, the San Francisco Bay Area has long been a hotbed for genre-bending string players. In recent years, a new generation of stringed adventurers has emerged, exploring everything from heavy metal to Afrobeat. The California Report's jazz critic Andrew Gilbert reviews one example, the first CD by the Musical Art Quintet.
For string players who aren't particularly interested in hewing to straight and narrow stylistic paths, these are the best of times. Nuevo Chamber, the debut album by the Musical Art Quintet, embodies the creative freedom that comes when musicians range widely across the traditions that draw their ears. Led by bassist Sasha Jacobson, the group came together about 4 years ago at San Francisco's Cafe Revolution, where a regular Sunday night chamber music jam session often packed the room. Every member of the quintet boasts conservatory training, but classically honed technique is only a starting point. The quintet draws a good deal of inspiration from jazz and various Latin American styles. They don't try to approximate the heft of brass or the power of percussion like some string ensembles. On Algo Nuevo, a salsa tune introduced by the late great conguero and bandleader Ray Barreto, the group turns the fire down from a boil to an insistent simmer. Jacobson is the quintet's leader and primary composer, but Sri Lankan-born violist Charith Premawardhana is the conceptual forefather. He founded Classical Revolution, an organization dedicated to bringing chamber music to populous venues, and he's collaborated with an international array of artists. The musical art quintet embraces a similarly global perspective. On Fela Feliz, a feature for violinist Anthony Blea, the group tips a bow to Nigerian Afrobeat patriarch Fela Kuti. As an album, Nuevo Chamber doesn't always cohere. The sole track featuring vocals falls flat despite its ostensibly uplifting lyrics. The band's concept, however, is laden with promise. Despite its stylistic diversity, the musical art quintet never tries to escape its string reality. It works its alchemy by absorbing material into its sonic universe. My favorite piece is Patty's, an arrangement of a gorgeous melody by the French Malagasy guitarist Solo Razov. There's one style that reoccurs throughout Nuevo Chamber. It's tango, both in traditional and electronica-inflected incarnations. But it's Jacobson's sensuous Ombligao en Argentina that fully reveals the quintet's generous spirit. Featuring recitation by poet and Latin music scholar Avochka, the piece brings you right out onto the dance floor, which is where so much of the best music takes you.
Andrew Gilbert is a San Francisco Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. He reviewed the new CD, Nuevo Chamber, by the Musical Art Quintet. A new exhibit at UC Riverside's Culver Center of the Arts uses sound and music to animate what could be described as a Native American legend. It's the story of Takwish, a creature who feeds on human souls and comes from the Kuia tribe that makes its home in and around Riverside County's San Jacinto Mountains. KPCC's Stephen Cuevas has more.
He is said to live in the cold womb of a giant boulder. Stray too close to his hunting ground, says San Francisco sculptor and sound artist Louis DeSoto, and he may consume your very soul.
You shouldn't sleep out in the open, because when you go to sleep, your spirit wanders, you know, it dreams. And while it's wandering around, it's vulnerable, which is sort of how Takwish operates. He crunches and eats your soul, and then you wander around and say, what happened to me?
Some say Takwish was a shaman, cast out of the Kuia Indian tribe after turning against his people. The version of the story DeSoto heard comes from Alvino Siva, a Kuia elder. Siva died in 2009, but DeSoto captured his voice years earlier.
I said, can you tell me about Takwish? He sat down and I recorded this story.
Alvino Siva told it in English and in Kuia. His voice echoes through the gallery.
I'm going to tell of what I know about our demigod, Takwish, created by Mukut, our creator, many years ago. The Mukut created powerful shamans, and some of them were good. And some of them were bad, that killed their people. And Takwish was one of them.
Other voices join Siva. Soprano Erin Neff created operatic recordings based on the Takwish story and sung in Kuia.
She took this story about Takwish and how he kidnaps a young maiden and makes her his wife and then eventually releases her. And if you step right on that, you'll be able to hear her voice singing. She, in a sense, becomes the maiden. It is said that Takwish lives in a rock, in a huge boulder. So we have this boulder sort of suspended over her, and you as the viewer can take her place and listen to her lament.
Now, move through the gallery, and the bird-like soprano gives way to wax cylinder recordings of Kauai bird songs made over 100 years ago by University of California anthropologist Lucille Hooper. The voices on these recordings sound forlorn. They swell up in tandem like a gust of wind and pull apart in a ghostly call and response. The songs have their origins in another part of the Kauai creation story. Mukat, the creator, introduced death to his people by showing how the hunter's arrow can be turned on himself. Angry, the people turn on their creator, just as they turned on Takwish.
And so they wind up poisoning him. And at this moment of death, they realize that they've destroyed their father. And all these people go wandering. And this wandering produces these songs, which were these sort of migratory songs about the migration.
Gerald Clark is a member of the Kauai band. He's also a bird singer who contributed to the Takwish project, but not without some hesitation.
You know, Takwish killed people and he ate their souls. The way we're raised is you don't mess with things like that. And as an artist myself, I've always been apprehensive about exploiting my own culture. And so I stay away from things like this myself in my own work. But I'm a firm believer, you know, you do something with a good heart and good things will happen.
Buddhism talks about the sort of the nature of suffering of humanity as unextinguishable desire.
Louis DeSoto says it's his own interest in Kauai culture and in the spiritual beliefs of other cultures that drew him to Takwish.
And when I heard the story of Takwish, I personally saw that as an embodiment of that. He's a great metaphor for the insatiable thirst of humans.
A giant replica of the Takwish boulder lair is suspended in the Culver Center's two-story atrium. Visitors wander beneath it, some snap pictures, others just linger in its shadow. But they may not want to linger too long, unless, of course, they're not terribly attached to their mortal souls. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
And that is the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Racho. Seal Mahler is our technical producer, with additional engineering by Paul Ancour. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen, with help from David Marks. Our interns are Andres Barraza and Liz Reed. Our senior producer this week is Victoria Maleone. The producer is Polly Stryker. Pat Flynn and Andrea Kissick were contributing editors. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The world standard for solar. SunPowerSolar.com.